Hare Krishna. We continue our discussion on leadership principles based on the Bhagavad Gita leadership sutras. We will discuss today redefine success. So Albert Einstein has famously said that problems cannot be solved at the same level of awareness that created them. Now, the Bhagavad Gita starts with Arjuna facing a heart-wrenching dilemma. In the first chapter, it depicts how Arjuna is overwhelmed. Shaknomi avasthatu pramativa cha me manah nimittani cha pashyami viparitani keshava. In 1.30, he describes in the Bhagavad Gita that wherever I see only misfortune. And my mind is reeling at the prospect of imminent, unavoidable misfortune that is coming. What should I do? I don't know. So, what was the predicament of Arjuna? He was about to fight a fratricidal war. And if he fought the war and won, his loved ones, his near and dear ones, especially his venerable teacher and his venerable grandsire, both would be dead. And his victory would be tainted by their blood. And if he didn't fight, then he would practically have to accept defeat. You know, the grievous insult that his wife had endured, that would go unavenged. And the unjust would continue to, rule the world. So, he just couldn't resolve and he became emotionally overwhelmed by it. And he turned to Krishna and asked, what should I do? So now the Gita addresses Arjuna's dilemma, but not at his level of reality. It raises his level of his understanding, his conceptions of life. And from there, from a higher spiritual level of reality, it offers him a new expanded definition of success. Now, Arjuna's dilemma originates in a materialistic definition of success. And at that level, it has no solution. The solution is to redefine success. And by the end of the Bhagavad Gita, it is this redefined conception of success, this expanded understanding of success, that is what restores Arjuna's morale. And he becomes ready to answer the call of duty. Now, do we also need to redefine success? Do we need to expand our definition of success? To understand this, we need to first look at the nature of our definition of success, what its characteristics are, and then we will see whether having an expanded definition of success that includes the spiritual will actually benefit us. So, we also have materialistic definitions of success, and the present definitions of success that we have are often deceptive, debilitating, and destructive. Let's see how. So, deceptive. You know, we live in a culture where often definitions of success are imposed on us. Subtly, no doubt, but still they are imposed. Now, how is that? We live in an age of propaganda. So, consider that, say, a company launches a new device, a new expensive cell phone, and immediately promos appear all over the media, say, showing a young manager brandishing a new mobile, while a cute girl glances admiringly at him and a sullen colleague glares enviously. And now a young manager in a company may well be having a good functional phone, but when he sees this ad, then he thinks, oh, if I just get that cell phone, then that will give me the admiration, the respect that I deserve but don't get. And though he does not need the new cell phone, Still, he purchases it and discards his old phone. And then he proudly parades his new cell phone. And as heads turn and eyebrows rise in admiration, he feels, oh yes, I have arrived. I am successful now. But his success is distressingly, agonizingly short-lived. Soon, a new device appears in the market. A mobile with some new feature. And all the hype shifts to that mobile. And nobody notices this old piece. And then this manager starts thinking, oh, I have to purchase that mobile. Then I will get the respect. Then I will be considered a success. And so he purchases that. And in this way, he's caught in a definition of success that never brings lasting success. And that keeps one perpetually dissatisfied. Now, what does this mean? Actually, purchasing a cell phone that we don't need is just one way in which we are enamored, in which a success is defined for us and the definition is practically thrust upon us. This is thrust so forcefully that often people today are prisoners of success. What do we mean by prisoners of success? No. A person who is a prisoner is shackled by bars, shackled in the movement by bars and walls. Similarly, people today are shackled in their actions by inflexible, restrictive definitions of success. So, let's see how people get caught in this, get allured into and caught in this prison of success. So, first there is the advertising industry. There is the advertising industry. Whenever a new product is launched, there's the manufacturing industry, the consumer product. First, there's the consumer products manufacturing industry, which specializes in producing attractive and often expensive products, many of which are luxury, which are not really necessary. So, and newer versions are produced, brand obsolescence is created, so that people will purchase the new products. So, there is this marketing industry. Then there is the advertising industry. The advertising industry now, once the products are made, they are not vitally essential, but people have to be made to feel that they are vitally essential. And so, what happens? These products are branded, portrayed as lifestyle products, as symbols of a successful lifestyle, as markers that a person is successful, and as definers of social prestige. And therefore, the advertisements make people feel that if I don't have this, then I'll be unsuccessful. And then after that, there is the whole marketing industry. So, showrooms and exhibits and supermarkets become filled with these products, prominently in their windows or display places. And then there is the banking industry, which offers credit cards and loans. Even if you don't have money, no problem. You purchase now, pay later. And in this way, people get caught in this prison of success where they just want newer and newer and newer things. And their whole life goes in pursuing that itself. Now, the problem here in pursuing this definition of success is that it is deceptive. No matter how much we purchase, we can never be successful because always something new will come up which will be defined as the marker of success, and we'll have to keep pursuing that more and more and more. Now, there is nothing wrong in purchasing new gadgets, especially if they have new features, they have good features which can offer better functionality and save time. then they can be purchased. The problem is not buying the device. The problem is buying into the underlying definition of success. Now, if we don't question that definition of success, then even if the device saves our time, that saved time will be not ours to use. It will be sucked up by that definition of success. How? Because that definition will make us search for newer products. So I got product A, I saved time by using it. Because I still have the definition of success, that the latest product, possession of the latest product means success. So therefore, I now start looking for the latest product that is there. And my time goes in seeking that product and planning how I can purchase it, how can I manage my finances, how I will use it. And then, in this way, the definition of success does not allow us to use our saved time. And that's why questioning this definition is important. It's a deceptive definition that can never actually bring happiness, bring success. Now, the problem further with this reduced definition of success is that it reduces the quest for success to a quest for money. Because success is thought it will bring happiness, and we think that success means to get money. So the quest for happiness, which we think will come from success, which we think will come from getting the products which require money, the quest for happiness gets reduced to a quest for money. And most people think that I am dissatisfied because I don't have enough money. If only I would get more money, then I would be happy. But is it true that more money will translate into more happiness? The statistics have shown that beyond that, when people don't have life's basic necessities, then certainly more money increases happiness. I'm hungry, and then definitely if I get money and then I get food, definitely I'll feel better. But beyond the satisfaction of basic life necessities, after that, more money doesn't translate into more happiness. Survey after survey has confirmed this. Let's consider some surveys here. There's research conducted by the University of Illinois with Ed Diener as the lead researcher. It found that the business magnates in America and the poor peasants in East Africa, both of them had the basic same happiness level. And then similarly, a survey was conducted in Princeton. And its result was published in Issue of Science, a very prestigious magazine. And what was the conclusion of that? The belief that high income is associated with good mood, that means wealthy people are happy, is widespread. So they are calling it a belief and they are saying it's widespread. But then it is widespread, but mostly illusory. Illusory. It is not true that rich people are happy people. And then similarly, World Value Survey. The findings of the researchers for World Value Survey, after they did a worldwide survey, they found that the desire for material goods, that people want money so that they can get more and more goods, desire for material goods, is a happiness suppressant. That means it doesn't actually lead to happiness, it checks happiness, it suppresses happiness. Because whatever happiness I have with my possessions, I cannot be satisfied because I want more, I want more, I want more. So in this way, we get trapped. Now, moving forward. So, now this is not to say that wealth is not important. Yes, wealth is definitely needed in life. It is one of life's primary necessities. But necessity is not the same as purpose. Necessity is what we live with. Purpose is what we live for. So, wealth is what we live with. It's like food. We need food. And if there's no food, there'll be a problem. But if there is, if we make food itself the goal of our life, then we cheat ourselves. So, we underutilize our life's potential. So, we shouldn't make the necessity of life a purpose of life. And actually, the whole idea, so this is how it is a deceptive, the idea that wealth will make me happy. But beyond that, it is also debilitating. debilitating means the whole idea, the definition of success is what? Okay, this new product has come, take it, purchase it. So it's the whole idea of grabbing everything new that comes, get it, that is success. So it actually makes us very impulsive. And researchers have found that the grabbers in life, those who act impulsively, often lack the abilities and qualities that are foundational to good leadership, to effective leadership. So it's Stanford University, Walter Meschel and other researchers in the 1960s started a survey on preschool children, very small children. And they were, this can be called as the marshmallow test or the grabbers versus the resistors study. So these are small children, they were shown a marshmallow in a small plate in front of them. Marshmallow is a kind of sweet candy. And they were told that, okay, now you can eat this marshmallow now if you want. But I am going out on an errand, and I'll come in about 20-30 minutes. If you can wait till then you will get one more marshmallow. You decide. And then the researcher would leave. And his children, most of them, they would not even wait for the researcher to leave. Immediately they would grab the marshmallow and eat it. And some children decided, no, they wanted two marshmallows, so they decided to wait. Now, some of them, they tried to, it seemed like an interminable wait. So, some of them tried to close their eyes. Some of them started playing with their hands and legs. Some of them started singing. Some of them started looking here and there. Some of them tried to go to sleep. And somehow, they killed their time. And then, finally, they got the two marshmallows. Now, these two children were divided into two groups. Grabbers, those who ate the marshmallow right away. Resistors is those who waited for the two marshmallows to come. Waited for 20 minutes. Now, these children were tracked about a decade later. And the difference between their personalities was found to be striking. So, it is found that the resistors, they were able to cope with stress much better. They were able to cope with pressure much better. They were able to, when they faced challenges, they were able to go on without giving up. And they were able to do things. They were self-reliant, confident that yes, I can do it. And when others told them to do it, also they were more trustworthy and capable. And not only from others, they would themselves take up initiative and dive into projects. And even there, they were able to still resist gratification for purpose. Now, in contrast, what was the nature of the grabbers? They were easily upset by frustrations. They would think of themselves as bad and unworthy. And when stress would come, they would become immobilized. They were, on one side, stubborn, that they would take a wrong decision and stick to it. On the other side, they were indecisive. They couldn't take any decision at all. So, they were prone to be mistrustful and resentful. They think that, life is not fair to me, I am not getting enough. And they would be jealous and envious. And they would react to small provocations with overreaction, leading to quarrels and fights. And still, they were unable to resist gratification. And even in the objective academic performances, the SAT scores of the resistors was an average 210 points more than that of the grabbers. So Daniel Goleman reports his studies in his book Emotional Intelligence, and he says there is perhaps no psychological skill more fundamental than resisting impulse. It's fundamental psychological skill. Now the whole idea of the prison of success is to make us indulge in impulse. See this product and purchase it immediately. And that idea is actually very destructive. Why? Because people spend a lot of money unnecessarily. And often many sale offers, they come with a sundown expiry. Sale only for today. Because their idea is when a sale with some discount or some facility is offered, it excites the impulses of people. and people will immediately, without thinking deeply, purchase it. And the sundown expiry is there because, you know, if people sleep on it, they'll think more about it, their impulses will cool down, and they will realize, I don't need it actually. And then they will not purchase it. So today's culture actually focuses on making us servants of our impulses, slaves of our impulses. Makes us think that acting on our impulses is success. But no, it is corrosive for the growth of leadership potential. Now, if you look at the quality at the character profile of the grabbers and the character profile of the resistors, we'll find that the grabbers were actually the people who were not having leadership qualities, whereas the resistors are those who were having leadership qualities. So actually, that means giving into indulgences is harmful for leaders. And the materialistic worldview encourages us to give into indulgences. In fact, grammarizes giving into indulgences, impulses. And that's why actually this materialistic worldview, materialistic definition of success is debilitating for our leadership potential. And going further, now this idea that wealth will lead to happiness, that positions, equate with happiness, is so deep-rooted that actually to counter it, we need to go even deeper and examine the fundamental worldview itself, the worldview of materialism. Now, how do we examine this worldview? The whole idea is that material things will make us happy. But have they actually made us happy? So, we can look at countries which are materially quite prosperous and see whether prosperity has translated into happiness. Now, David Myers, in his book, The American Paradox, Spiritual Hunger in an Age of Plenty, he compares American statistics between the 1960s and around 2000, over a period of around 40-50 years. And he found that during this period, the divorce rate had doubled. The teen suicide rate had tripled. The prison population had quadrupled. The violent crime rate had quadrupled. The prison population had pentupled. Pentupled means five times. And the number of babies born outside marriage had sextupled. And the overall depression had increased 10 times as compared to the pre-World War II level. So now, actually, this was a phase of quite a bit of prosperity in American history. And yet, these various objective material parameters of material well-being have all are giving a report that people are not happy. If people are divorced, if people are depressed, people are committing crimes, people are getting imprisoned, people are committing suicides, how can such people be considered happy? So again, this point is that materialistic definition of success doesn't lead to happiness. So American people often have all the products that are glamorized to society because they have, relatively speaking, it's a wealthy country. And they can afford the products, but they're not happy. Even not from some ethereal philosophical point of view, but even from objective parameters of individual social well-being. So now this raises the question, why is it that we're not happy? Because materialistic definition of success is an incomplete definition. We need to expand our definition. You know, our spiritual side is a very important side for us. And our spiritual dimension, if it is unaddressed, Gita servants give the example that when our spiritual side is not addressed, then we become like fish out of water. And the fish may be put on the most comfortable couch, but it will be tormented, restless. Similarly, we may be provided the best of material comforts, the best trappings of material success. But if our spiritual side is not addressed, then we will remain discontent. And actually the purpose of addressing our spiritual life is not just negative, to avoid discontent. there is a positive to it. It is our spiritual side is our opportunity. It is an opportunity to higher wisdom and higher fulfillment. So, the Vedic scriptures explain that our spiritual faculty is a unique human privilege. Among all the life forms that are present on earth, we humans alone have the evolved consciousness capable of perceiving life's spiritual dimension. And we have an opportunity for spiritual growth. This is called as Brahma Jigyasa, the capacity for spiritual inquiry. Now when we look at how the spiritual inquiry can benefit us. See, when we say it's an opportunity is for something higher. And when we don't use that opportunity, then we miss the higher benefits that were there. So to understand this, compare, say, a student from an IIT or an IIM in an IIM, top college. And then after getting into that college, the student is constantly busy thinking, where can I get good food to eat? And all the time is spent just eating good food without considering studies and career. You say, what a tragic underutilization. You wanted food, you could have got it anywhere. You have got now into IIM, you should use it for something higher, build a bright career. So, similarly, when we have our higher spiritual faculty, it's like we are in a spiritual IIM. And to not use that faculty, and to reduce or restrict our definition of success to only materialistic definition is like actually just seeking food in an IIM. Now, this is not only underutilization, underuse, it can also be abuse. That is harmful. How? Consider another example. It's like not using our spiritual faculty, using our human resources only for materialism is like using a Mercedes for plowing. Try to imagine this. A Mercedes is going through a field. What will happen? The Mercedes will get spoiled and the field will also get spoiled. And that is precisely what is happening in society today, in the world today. Now when we use our human resources only for materialistic things, then we spoil our environment. And we harm ourselves too. How do we harm our environment? Now, we all know that there is a major ecological crisis that is already there. And ecological Armageddon, destruction, may be there in the future due to the climate change. Now, this has many causes. But most of the problem that the ecology is facing have originated from human misuse of ecological resources, from human interfering with and disrupting delicate ecological balances that sustain our fragile biosphere. So now, there are many biologists, many scientists, such as E.O. Wilson, who have studied the delicate balances in nature, and they have found that every species contributes something to the ecology. So, for example, if the shrub and grass die out, then the herbivores will suffer. If the herbivores die out, the carnivores will suffer. But there is one species which doesn't contribute anything to the ecology. If that species dies out, no one would suffer. There would be no problem in the ecology. In fact, most problems would be solved if that species dies out or is wiped out. And which is that species? It is a human species. So now, if we have a class, now humans are considered to be among the most intelligent among all the species in the creation. And now, normally, if they are most intelligent, they should be making the most constructive contribution, not the most destructive contribution. If in a class we know a particular student is the most intelligent, you would expect that student to be contributing the most to the class, not contributing the worst to the class, isn't it? So why is it that we humans, the most intelligent, are making a destructive contribution? Could it be that our contribution is not meant to be at a material level, it is meant to be at a spiritual level? And when we try to reduce our action only at the material level, then our action stimulates, causes destruction, causes harm. Similarly, what about ourselves? Now we see that actually we are in big trouble. Mental health problems are the biggest health challenge of the current century. Now we have stress, depression, addiction, suicide, major problem in society. And all these are problems which are of catastrophic and tragic magnitudes. And significantly, the WHO, which calls suicide, for example, as a tragic social health problem, suicide. You know, there are, according to WHO, over 1 million people commit suicide every day. That means there are several people who commit suicide. There are dozens of people who commit suicide. There are million suicide people who commit suicide every year. Sorry, that means actually there are over a dozen people who commit suicide, more than a dozen people who commit suicide every hour. So it's a horrible problem. And now naturally, suicide and mental health problems can have many causes. But a common denominator is that people are so frustrated with their lives that they feel that dying would be better than living. Could it be that the definition of success which they have got is so incompatible with their nature that they just can't live with it? And now, if this were true, then how would we find that out? Now, we would find that people who live spiritually have better parameters of well-being. Now, is that true? If a Mercedes is used for riding on a smooth road, then it will perform much better. So if it is true that we are meant to perform or contribute, if our definition of success needs to incorporate a spiritual dimension, then is it that those who include a spiritual dimension are better off in life? Yes, that is what science has found out. The classic in study of religion and health, a major landmark, was the Handbook of Religion and Health. It actually compiled thousands of studies from all over the world in 2000 published studies from all over the world correlating people's religious commitment on one side and the parameters of physical and mental health on the other side. And they found overall that people who attended a spiritual program at least once a week. So spirituality was defined. It is difficult to define spirituality. We'll discuss that later. But they defined it here, quantified it as at least once a week they attended a spiritual program. They lived on an average 7 years longer than those who didn't attend at all. Religious people showed significantly lower levels of drug and alcohol abuse, premature sexual involvement, criminal delinquency, and suicidal tendencies than their non-religious counterparts. And elderly people with deep personal religious faith had a stronger sense of well-being and life satisfaction than their non-religious peers. You know, Koenigskind Cluny was one of the researchers in this study, lead researchers, and he concluded that a high SQ, faithfulness to God, appears to benefit all people, people of all means, educational levels and ages. So in layman's language, saying that yes, religious commitment, as spiritual commitment, is beneficial. Now this brings us to an interesting and important question. The book is called as Handbook of Religion and Health. It uses the word religion, but then its conclusion, Cunning uses the word spiritual in spiritual quotient. So what is the relationship between spiritual and religious? Most people today are open to being spiritual but are uncomfortable about being religious. Why? Because spirituality signifies openness to various principles and practices that may add value to our life, that may help us grow. Whereas religious often conveys belief in some dogmas or adherence to some rituals. It often signifies close-mindedness. And in that sense, it seems to be undesirable. So now, leaders naturally would want to be not sectarian in any way, not close-minded in any way. We live in a secular world, so leaders will naturally want to be not sectarian. So they would prefer to be spiritual, but not religious. Now, what does the Gita say about being this spiritual religious issue? Firstly, these words are so complex that they can have many meanings. So let's first reduce the words to specific points. Spiritual, as in the spiritual but not religious, is that idea, is that spiritual refers to openness to various experiences and methods. But spiritual is also a level of consciousness, a level of reality, a way of pursuing things which needs to be attained. So like this is the material level of reality, this is the spiritual level of reality. So spiritual is the level of reality and religious is the process for rising from the material level to the spiritual level. So now philosophy, so spirituality according to Bhagavad Gita has, from the Bhagavad Gita's worldview, has two components. There is philosophy and there is religion. So spirituality has philosophy and religion. So philosophy is that which enables people to perceive higher realms of reality. Philosophy explains how there are higher realms of reality existing, and it gives propositions and it makes a coherent case for the existence of this higher realm of reality, of existence. And religion involves practices for rising to that higher realm of reality. So the Bhagavad Gita talks about this in say 9.2 when it says, Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam Pavitramitam Uttamam Pratyakshavagamam Dharmyam Susukham Kartum Avyayam. So it says that this knowledge which is being given, it's a very special knowledge. And then it says pratyakshavagamam. It can be experienced pratyaksha. It can be verified by direct experience from within. So it is experientially verifiable. That's the point being talked about here. Now, what does this imply? It implies that actually spirituality is akin to a science. In science, there are two limbs. There is science, there is theory, and there is experiment. The theory, say, makes a case for something. So, Newton's theory of gravitation made a case that there is a force which attracts every particle of matter with every other particle of matter to every other particle of matter, with a force that is directly proportional to their masses and inversely proportional to the square of their distance. So, this is theory. And now, the experiment offers methods for either proving or disproving that theory. So, if there is just such a force, then even not just a fruit, a stone, a piece of metal should fall. So now, similarly, if philosophy makes the propositions and religion provides the methods for verifying. So in this sense, philosophy and religion form a harmonious combination. So now, how does this idea of spirituality as having philosophy and religion relate with our spiritual but not religious discussion? So now, if somebody wants to be spiritual but not religious, in the sense that they want to be open-minded, the Gita definitely recommends open-mindedness, because the Gita says to rise from the material level to the spiritual level, there are multiple methods. There is an express way and there are multiple ways. The Gita itself talks about multiple yogas, and the Gita has an extraordinarily inclusive assertion when it states that Mama Vartamanu Vartante Manushya Partha Sarvasha. In 4.11 it states that all people are on my path. That means people are on the express way to the divine in various ways and at various levels. So now with this point, let's move backwards and see what this means is that if spiritual is a level of awareness and religion is a process to rise to that level of awareness, then there has to be some practice that has to be there. Some religious method has to be practiced. So whatever people practice for whatever method they practice for rising to the spiritual level, that will be their religion. So in that sense, to be spiritual, one has to be religious. But one doesn't to be spiritual, but one doesn't have to be close-minded. The Gita itself doesn't mandate close-mindedness, because there are multiple ways to rise from the material platform to the spiritual platform. And in that sense, it is open-minded. So now, with this apprehension of sectarianism put aside, let's recap now, once again quickly. How is it that redefining success will benefit leaders if they expand the definition of success to include the spiritual? So we discussed how actually our spiritual side is a valuable resource that can promote our well-being. And actually, if our well-being is promoted, we perform better in life, in all aspects of our life. So now leaders know how important that in the competitive world today, how important it is to make optimal use of every resource that is available. So if, say, the leaders discover that one of the team members has got a talent which is not known, the leader discovers and taps the talent, and that discovery can be like a game changer for the whole team. Similarly, discovering our spiritual side and tapping our spiritual resources can be a game changer. Now, at the core, Gita says, lies a reservoir of positivity, powerful, intangible but indestructible. When we connect it with it, then we get the calm and clarity to better utilize all our outer resources. We can deal with stress better. We can deal with life tensions better. And actually, in the past, many leaders would integrate the material and spiritual side harmoniously. Unfortunately, in contemporary times, because of overemphasis on materialism, the spiritual side has been sidelined. But leaders, and this has cost society dearly, as we discussed with the various statistics. So leaders have the opportunity and the responsibility to correct this wrong. Now, if leaders can tap their spiritual side, if they use the latest scientific technologies and the latest spiritual and the most sophisticated spiritual methodologies, then they can become leaders par excellence. And the Gita invites all of us to become leaders of that caliber. Thank you. Hare Krishna.